Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Harris, Judge Klapacki, Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, July 25th, 2024. We have three cases today on our oral Zoom calendar and one non-oral case. Counsel, we are conducting this proceeding on Zoom. We're making a recording. Only an audio recording, though, will be available on the public website later. Each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. If you would please keep your microphone muted when you're not the party speaking, that would be appreciated. And otherwise, with that, I believe, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Laura Heinrich. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Dustin Medcalf. In our brief, I raised four different issues. I expect to speak about the first issue and the second issue primarily today. The first issue involves whether or not there was a future action that was described in the threats of violence that was presented at trial. This is a question of de novo review because it deals with the scope of the statute, question of whether or not a threat of violence requires there to be a future act that's alleged.
Can I ask you, counsel, as we get into that, what would it mean? I mean, the case law talks about a threat is whether a person will act according to its tenor. That's one of the descriptions of it. There's no such thing as threatening to do something in the past. In the past, I will harm you. So a threat has to, by case law already, necessarily entail that a threat to do something, which obviously is in the future. So what needs to be construed in the statute? I'm missing where the statutory construction element comes in.
So the issue here is that you have Mr. Medcalf speaking about generally wanting to sue the city of Round Lake and specifically Ms. Walker, who is the clerk at the city of Round Lake. And then he talks about two hypothetical things that could have happened in the past that didn't, and one of which doesn't even have anything to do with Ms. Walker or her son. And the state's argument here and at trial, even in closing, is that these things sound generally like an implied, I might do something in the future that looks like these things that I didn't do in the past.
Right. It's an implicit threat.
Right.
Talking about past violence or hypothetical violence is an implicit threat of future violence. Isn't that what this is about?
It is, but I would say that in interpreting what that requires, you have to keep the First Amendment in mind. Ultimately, these cases come out of a small slice of types of speech that are allowed to be criminalized, when in general they're not, that deal with true threats. And a true threat includes not just I'm angry, I'm yelling, I'm saying things that are unpleasant. It has to include an additional part that I'm going to act and do these things. Not this sort of, I would put forward that the state's interpretation of act in the tenor of almost becomes like a vibe. I'm going to act in accordance with how I was coming across, angry, upset. And I would agree that these are ultimately, especially the sixth phone call, where Mr. Medcalf is really angry. He's upset. He's ranting. But he's never saying, I am going to do something in the future about these things. It's to get to the point of trying to parse out every single angry passing thing that he said to then include that that is a threat that he's going to act in the future in accordance with the vibe or the feel or the anger is taking that too much far from the First Amendment analysis, which ultimately requires that there be an actual future imminent conduct that's part of what you're saying. So the cases that the state cites to are helpful in understanding the difference. In Franks, in, I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, but Bajurgum, these are situations where people are speaking angrily, and they also include, I'm going to come and see you later, or I am going to shoot somebody at work. They go that extra step. It's not just the anger. It's not just the talking about these things that were happening in their life that were making them upset. They ultimately do include a, I'm going to follow through and act. And it's
so that, it sounds, if I may, less that, yes. I mean, I think we would all agree that it has to threaten a future act, because you can't threaten a past act. That seems, and what you seem to be focused on is that it needs to be an explicit threat of a future act. Why can't there be an implicit? We know there can be through conduct. Why can't it be an implicit threat? Like, man, I'm not going to do it, but I would sure like to bring my AR-15 to your house, blah, blah, blah. Which at some point, couldn't someone reasonably think, despite someone's even active denial, that they're intending to threaten someone? Or is it just if the defense says, no, not my intent, or doesn't explicitly say that they're going to do it, that that's not enough?
I'd first note that even the hypothetical that's being posed here is I'd sure like to. That's more than what we have here in this case. You don't have him saying, I'd sure like to. That's very close to the line of saying, I am going to do something in the future.
So it could be an implicit threat of future action. That could be sufficient.
But I will say that in this area, there is scant case law. You have ultimately, the cases dealing with the implicit threat are through action. So you have Murphy is talking about that a lot, but you have this sort of like classic Godfather horse in the bed type, head in the bed type of conduct there, where it's very violent and it's clear that this is signaling that something violent is going to happen in the future. These aren't their speech cases in some ways, but you have actually Mr. Metcalf using words here. So the words that he uses matter. So there's scant case law. I would suggest that even the language that in this hypothetical gets to the point of saying that I am going to, I would like to act in this way, versus you have Mr. Metcalf really truly just ranting. And when you have somebody who is, and I'm not suggesting here that this is the sort of transitory anger defense, but he is ranting and he's talking about sort of past things that didn't happen. And he's talking about a lawsuit, you never have that second step of, I'd like to act in this way. I'm thinking about acting in this way, or I'm going to go after you. The only thing that he says is, I'll see you in court, that he's going to sue her civilly, which is, you know, a scary thing, but it is a threat that we allow. It's not a threat of violence. It's just this type of recourse you can take that can take people's livelihood. You can sue them for a lot of money. Those things do not fall into the sort of violent act situation. And I do think that when you say threat, just sort of as a general use of the word, versus threat very specifically when we talk about true threat in First Amendment, there does have to be a sense of imminent action. And he hasn't described any imminent action. Just being angry and talking about these past experiences does not create imminent action. I will say even the, I think that the unpublished opinion that the respondent cites to Lacey really doesn't think about First Amendment analysis and seems to be just completely focused on whether there's apprehension, which is the person is feeling apprehension because of the conduct, which is a totally different element. But I will say even in that case, what's alleged is, I have a gun, I've killed somebody in the past, I know where to bury a body. Those are things that get to the point of saying, I am going to do the things I did before now. And basically saying that I don't want to know the address because I will get blamed, which ultimately does talk about sort of imminent, I would be doing X, Y, or Z, versus with Mr. Metcalf, there's none of that. You don't see that in anything that he said. And I think it doesn't have to be so bright line of, I explicitly say that on Tuesday I'm going to come and do X, but you do have to have enough in there that includes a plan to act in a certain way, or that you're saying in this way, I'm going to act in this certain way, not just that you're angry and you're transferring your anger and ranting to the other person in a way that makes them feel apprehension. There are different statutes that you can penalize that behavior with. It's not a threat of violence that he's going to act in the threat of violence. I think if there isn't actually any type of imminent action, which is the language from Schweppe and from I'm going to say this case wrong as well, Mrozinski, as well as Murphy, all of them include this sort of imminent acting in a violent way that we just don't see here in the facts of this case. And I think that the reason is that there's not a lot of discussion about this, is that all of these statutes are thought about in the context of the First Amendment. You're not supposed to read them to create constitutional problems. So when you're carving out this exception for true threats, it's within the case law of the First Amendment, and that already talks about there needing to be some action that you're imminently going to do as being something that's different than protected speech under the First Amendment. So I think for those reasons, you ultimately need to have more than what we have here. And I do think it is a statutory interpretation issue, not just a sufficiency. And I can talk more about that if the court's interested, but my view of the case.
Well, just Amy, yeah. Just tell me specifically what term in a statute you're construing and what is missing from the Supreme Court decisions on what, I assume it's threat.
It is okay. What threat.
All right. And under Murphy, a threat is actions or statements which, considered in a context, indicate future more serious acts of violence may follow. So the Supreme Court has, I think, construed it. What's missing and what construction would be added? What are you asking for that's not already defined?
So the cases don't talk about that it needs to be a definition. The reason that it's statutory construction is because it's looking at whether the conduct in this case falls under the statute. It's not asking whether there's sufficient evidence have been proven. It's whether the conduct taken as it is would fall under the statute. And when this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court addresses whether the conduct is covered by the statute, that's engaging in statutory interpretation. That's why there is de novo review, because it becomes sort of a category of things that wouldn't be under the statute. And that's what every single one of those cases talk about. It's sort of first, it's looking at, well, does a disassembled firearm, can that be under the statute of firearm? And they look at the record when they're determining whether it can, first in the sort of de novo review, because it ultimately defines the scope of the statute. And then the second prong, which the respondent lays out as well, is that they then look whether under these circumstances, sufficiency of the evidence. That is the same for all of these cases. It's whether this particular conduct falls under the statute at all. And so that's the first issue here, is that is this conduct, which doesn't have a threat of violence, or a threat of future violence, does that fall under the statute at all?
I look at those cases, Hayes, and I think, well, whatever, which one is the firearm case? I believe all, when we talk about, thank you, statutory construction, statutory interpretation, the norm is, okay, let's look, what does the statute say? Is there ambiguity? What's the ambiguity? If there is, and we apply tools of statutory construction, and then they decide what the statute means, and then they do a sufficiency. I'm just wondering, where's the first part of that in this case? I don't see argument about, are there two reasonable readings of this, of the term? Then we have to look at statutory construction canons, or if there's just only one reason, the typical statutory interpretation analysis that I don't see happening.
So in every single one of these cases, it's not a question of the construction of the statute. It's that you're going to interpret the scope of the statute in determining whether this conduct is ultimately covered by it. That is what the question they're asking in Stone, in Hayes, in Bradley, in Olson. And ultimately, that first prong isn't about looking, is there ambiguity in the statute? It's under these facts, these circumstances, does the statute actually cover this at all?
That's typically a sufficiency of evidence argument, isn't it?
There's two parts to ultimately these arguments. To the standard and to the argument that why it's under de novo review in the first part. The first part is they still look at the record. You have the Minnesota Supreme Court doing that, this court doing that in published opinions over and over again, where they look to see, is this conduct that you're talking about, would it be covered by the statute? That's part one. And that's why it's de novo review, It's because you're ultimately defining the scope of the statute in ruling one way or the other. The second part would be, okay, now that we've determined that this type of conduct is covered or not, well, if it's not covered by the statute, you're sort of done. But if it is covered by the statute, then we look at, is there sufficiency here? Did the state actually prove their case?
So under sufficiency, does it matter what the recipient of the threat, how the recipient viewed the threat?
So for the particular issue of whether there was a threat, that's a separate element. They do also have to prove ultimately how the person responded as another element. So yes, that would be part of ultimately what the state has to prove, but it's not part of this particular element that we're talking about. And I can see my time is about to expire, so I will reserve additional comments for rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. I just want to start with this whole question of de novo review versus a sufficiency of the evidence review. And I think, Judge Smith, you're absolutely right. The first piece is missing from appellant's argument. There's no debate about what the statute means and what it requires. The Supreme Court's been clear that it requires a threat to commit a future crime of violence. And the Supreme Court has been also equally clear that that threat can be an implicit threat as well as an explicit threat. And the necessary logical outcome of appellant's proposed rule of law is one that an implicit verbal threat can never satisfy the conduct in the statute, satisfy the requirements of the statute, which is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decisions. And two, that as long as a clever defendant couches all of their discussion of a crime of violence in the past tense, as this court recognized in Lacey, there's a safe harbor under the statute. That's absurd. That's not consistent with what the statute's intended to do. And I would also like to point out, appellants talked a lot about the First Amendment today, but has never made any argument that his conduct is constitutionally protected under the First Amendment and that therefore it cannot be criminalized. The appellant has never raised in this appeal a constitutional claim. And this court has been fairly consistent in saying that constitutional claims that aren't raised in the briefing and aren't raised below are waived. So to the extent that that's being discussed here for the first time today, that's completely inappropriate. There is, Judge Klopaki, you're absolutely right. What we're here on is a typical sufficiency of the evidence standard of review. Do the facts here allow a jury to reasonably conclude that the defendant violated the statute? That's the decision the jury gets to make. And what appellant is asking this court to do—
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, at some level, I think sometimes it's a terminology problem, like de novo versus legally sufficient. I mean, Olson ends up saying the evidence is legally sufficient, which is, I think, what we do. In other words, we decide as a matter of law whether the evidence, under the sufficiency standard even, whether the evidence is sufficient, right, to sustain a conviction. So, I mean, I assume, and I actually on rebuttal, Ms. Heinrich can speak to this, like the part of the sufficiency standard is that you take when there's a jury verdict, you assume that the jury believed, you know, that it found the facts in favor of the verdict, right? And I assume that we're not, even under the de novo review that is advocated by the appellant, that we're not supposed to become a fact finder, you know, make independent factual determinations, unless I'm wrong about that, but you can turn to that. But, you know, it's still a legal question, right? And so whether it's legally sufficient or not, after you decide, you know, the evidence, or consider the evidence and favorable to the verdict.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, ultimately, this court is making a legal determination that the evidence was sufficient. But I think the important thing is that the standard for determining what is legally sufficient isn't a de novo standard. It is a highly deferential, the most deferential standard of review we have. And all it requires is that there be evidence in the record from which the jury could reasonably conclude that the defendant committed the crime. Here, that he made a threat to commit a future crime of violence. And when you look at the profanity-laced tirade in which he engaged in, describing in some painful detail the crimes he could have committed against the victim's son and against other police officers, when you take that all in the context, and is his clear intent to cause harm, to cause apprehension, by his very own words in the phone calls, under those facts taken as a whole in context, there is sufficient evidence to allow a jury to reasonably conclude that the defendant made a threat to commit a future crime of violence, even though he didn't say, "I will" in the future, even though he said, "I could." In this regard, the statements here are remarkably like those in State v. Lacey. State v. Lacey applied the well-settled law to the particular facts of the case, and the particular facts there are remarkably similar to the facts here. And I don't see any meaningful distinction between those. Again, as this court recognized there, the fact that somebody couched their language in the past tense doesn't give them a safe harbor, an ollie-ollie income-free to avoid liability under the statute. That's simply not what the jurisprudence requires. An implicit threat is sufficient to satisfy the requirement that there be a threat of to commit a future crime of violence. And that's precisely what we have here. I mean, there's quite frankly, I would submit no other reasonable explanation for the defendant engaging in this repeated and painful discussion about what he could have done in the past to the victim's son. It simply doesn't make any sense otherwise. And the jury, again, we're not here under the circumstantial evidence standard of review. So the jury, we defer to the jury, and as long as that evidence would reasonably allow them to conclude that he committed the crime, the evidence is legally sufficient. So I disagree that there's any element of de novo review here. I quite frankly, as I argued in my brief, think that Olson, insofar as it suggested that whether something constitutes a threat is subject to de novo review, or explicitly held that, is wrong and should be explicitly overruled by this court. The reality is that the Supreme Court has been abundantly clear. It has never adopted the framework that appellant is actually proposing, where they say whether the defendant's conduct falls within the scope of the statute is something that's reviewed de novo. Quite frankly, that would allow defendants to make that argument every time and make every ordinary sufficiency of the evidence case into a statutory interpretation case that's reviewed de novo. If there's a legitimate dispute about what the statute means or what the statute requires, that question is asked in the abstract as a question of law and answered in the abstract. Bradley does that. Stone does that. And then it's only the when you get to the particulars of the case, that's only when you get into the second prong and you ask whether the facts are sufficient under the interpretation of the statute that's been adopted, if the jury could reasonably conclude that. That first piece, again, is missing here. There's no argument. There's no beef about what the statute means or about what the statute requires. And quite frankly, to the extent that the appellant is now arguing that perhaps an implicit verbal threat doesn't fall within the scope of the statute, I think that's a new argument raised here at oral argument for the first time in response to the court's concerns about the scope of review and should be deemed to have been waived. If that was really what the argument was, that an implicit verbal threat doesn't satisfy the statute, then we should have had the argument under those terms. But that's not the way the issue was framed by appellant. It simply isn't. She's never argued that an implicit verbal threat. He has never argued that an implicit verbal threat is insufficient to satisfy the requirements of the statute. Instead, it's just been an argument that my specific conduct doesn't fall within the scope of the statute. But that's just a sufficiency of the evidence question. Nothing more, nothing less. And this court should treat it like every other run-of-the-mill sufficiency of the evidence question and and apply the deferential traditional standard of review. And I submit that when the court does that, the evidence is more than sufficient to allow the jury to reasonably conclude that the appellant violated the statute. And unless the court has any further questions for me, I would simply ask this court to affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel for appellant.
Okay, there are a couple of quick things that I do want to address from respondent's argument. First, the issue about the First Amendment. All of the cases that define the scope of the threats of violence talk about the First Amendment, Mazursky, as well as Schweppe, as well as Murphy. And specifically in response to respondent's argument, we did cite to the U.S. Supreme Court case, Brandenburg, talking about why the threats includes this future action. Ultimately, the definition of threats comes out of First Amendment case law. So by us asserting that there needs to be a future act that's included is part of the First Amendment analysis of why threats, true threats, can actually be criminalized. So I would submit that that is not waived. Secondly, I wanted to deal with the facts that were talked about in respondent's argument. There was no language here at any point that included could have done this to her son. That ultimately would be an implied threat. That language was not there. The one time that they talked about a interaction at a gas station, that was with another sheriff's deputy or the sheriff named Chris. And it was talking about the context of being on equal footing now that they're going to be in a lawsuit, and it's sort of like having a fight, and talked about what would happen there. The only future action that was actually talked about was having a boxing match at the YMCA with a consensual waiver of liability and a choice by the other party to show up. And that, to the extent that my argument today sounded like I was saying that an implicit threat couldn't actually satisfy the statute, that is not what I was arguing. What I was arguing is that there needs to actually be a level of communication that is suggesting that there's going to be future conduct. And ultimately, that is just not here. And finally, I would push back on a respondent's explanation or description of the Supreme Court cases in Bradley, Colvin, Hayes, et cetera. Every single one of those cases in determining whether the scope of the statute and the de novo review part covered the conduct actually scoured the record first. They scour what's in the record in determining whether or not this is covered by the statute. And that's in, you know, one of the arguments is that Colvin was weird in terms of its posture, but you have other cases where they were looking at ultimately a tried case in Hayes, as well as in Bradley. So for, in terms of—
And then, if I may interrupt, with respect to factual findings, you don't think we should be making factual findings, right?
No, ultimately the record is there. The question is whether or not it includes a threat of future violence. And that's a legal question.
Okay, so if there was conflicting evidence about what was said or even et cetera, we would assume that, like under the sufficiency standard, you know, the facts, the circumstances of facts, whatever, the facts rather, do that, that support the verdict.
Yes, this is a rare occasion where ultimately there's actually a recording of everything that was said and the basis of the threats of violence. So the court has the ability to just hear the words and see the transcript. There's not much debate about what was actually said versus what wasn't said. The question is whether or not it was enough to convey a future act of violence, and
whether it's legally sufficient. Well, and I guess as Olson ended, in its analysis, whether it's legally sufficient. And do you, is there a different outcome depending on your advocated de novo standard versus the state sufficiency standard in your view?
Ultimately, it seems like the state in its oral argument was saying that they agree there has to be a future act that is alleged here. And so ultimately, I don't know that that's been said before. And I don't know that the depiction of these cases has been that it does require a future act. So with that understanding, ultimately, no, I don't think there would be a difference if it were de novo review or sufficiency. And I see that my time has elapsed. For all the reasons in the brief and discussed today, we'd ask that Mr. Medcalf's convictions be overturned and his case be either sent back to district court if it's on issue 4 or just vacated on the other issues.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, for your briefing and your argument today. We'll have a